If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Norwich City delivered an early Halloween horror show as they imploded to a club record equaling defeat at Chelsea. There were no chainsaws involved, but it was very much a football massacre at Stamford Bridge as the Canaries were thrashed 7-0 by the European champions. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast, where we will join the vast majority of City fans in wallowing in Premier League misery to start with, but we will swiftly start looking forward to what happens next. I'm your host, Dave Freezer. We come to you in association with Future Radio 107.8 FM, and joining us is Paddy Davitt and Connor Southwell. At the time of recording on Sunday morning, Daniel Farke remains head coach, and we've heard no suggestion that that will change ahead of Sunday's game against Leeds. But clearly, this is an extremely painful time for the club, so it's difficult to say that with certainty. Connor, I'll come to you first. We've seen the damning analysis from the pundits. Joe Cole has said it looks like under-18s against men at times. Jermaine Gina said it was shocking. Daniel Farke admitted it was embarrassing. Grant Hanley has offered an apology. How are you feeling about it all the morning after that horrible day?
Yeah, probably even a bit worse than I did at the final whistle at Stamford Bridge yesterday. I think if you connected with Norwich City in any way, whether you're a fan, a former player, you do the job we do, I think it's hard to watch that performance and reflect on that performance with anything other than embarrassment, to be honest. It wasn't a performance befitting of a Premier League team. It wasn't a performance befitting of a Norwich City team. And I think the frustration is that you can accept going to Stamford Bridge and getting beaten at any time, any team. That can happen to anyone. And we say it a lot on this podcast as well. There's a way to get beat. There's a way to lose a football match. You might not be as good as your opponents, but at least have some commitment, some heart, some fight. At least go and press the ball. At least work as a collective. And none of that was on display. It was they were comprehensively beaten in every single department. There was not really a bright spot. There wasn't a player on the pitch in yellow and green who offered probably any positivity. And I think the majority of the game, Daniel Farke stood on the touchline shaking his head. And I think there would have been 1,500 in the away end, plus however many Norwich fans were watching at home on TV who would have been shaking their heads with him. It was a humiliation. It was annihilation, really, wasn't it? And I think Chelsea will probably have had tougher training sessions. It's really difficult to reflect on that with anything other than embarrassment, I think, for me. And I would imagine a lot of Norwich City fans are waking up this morning. And sometimes, as we said off air, sometimes you can wake up after a result and it processes a bit more and you can maybe reflect on it a little bit better. But actually, if anything, it probably feels a little bit more painful, particularly given the reaction that has followed and the criticism and probably the perception of Norwich as well amongst people who aren't fans. It's painful. It's really sore. It's really raw. And I think the people feeling it most will be the supporters who, sadly, again, are watching their team in the Premier League getting beaten too regularly, too easily. And this also while other promoted teams are winning games and performing relatively well. So it stings because I think it's more the fact that Norwich fans have been here before. This isn't the first time they've been in the Premier League. This isn't the first time that they've seen a Norwich team in the Premier League like this. It's happening far too often, and it's happening too regularly, and it's happened before under this head coach as well. And I think when you kind of sit here and you think about 2 years ago, to be in a position where you're looking at a team now which is maybe even worse than the one that was performing 2 years ago that ended up with 21 points. I think that's probably quite a scary prospect. It's what, 19 Premier League games now without a win? That needs to change against Leeds, doesn't it? Because if it's 20, then I think we're going to be in a position where, forget soul searching and everything else, I think there's going to be some very serious questions put at the door of this head coach. And sadly, just to round off kind of this opening monologue, I suppose, in the first nine matches, I think everyone, us fans, ex-players, current staff even maybe as well, will have been looking for evidence that this time is going to be different, that they were going to have enough about them to stay up. And you have to say, whether it's performance data, whether it's what you're seeing with your eyes, whether it's results, seeing nothing so far to suggest that this isn't going to be another long march to the championship. And then that raises questions again about whether everyone involved has enough stamina to go again. We talk so often about this being a roller coaster, but if you go around the roller coaster seven times, by the eighth time, it's probably not as entertaining anymore. So yeah, it's really painful. And you can't help but think if everyone knows what's going to happen if this goes on. But it doesn't get any easier to watch or accept, really. I think that's it, really. Just pain and embarrassment and humiliation. I'm sure a lot of Norwich City fans are waking up as we record on Sunday morning thinking probably exactly the same thing.
Yeah, there's no sugarcoating it. There's no leg to stand on. The club can't complain about people moaning. Quite literally, they've only lost 7-0 before three times in the club's history. Twice of those were in the 1930s. They lost at Walsall in Division 3 South in 1930. They lost at Sheffield Wednesday in the second tier in 1938. And the one that we'll all remember is Manchester City in 2013 under Chris Hughton, when they also lost 7-0. They actually bounced back from that one. They won 3-1 at home against West Ham in the next game, and they won three of the next five. I had a quick look earlier. So that's an interesting element to it, because they'd also lost 4-0 at Man United in the League Cup in a few days before that game in the Hughton era. Technically, the club's record defeat is 10-2 against Swindon, but that was in the Southern League in 1908. So I think really when the club joined the Football League in 1920 is where you go from, or certainly that's where I think they should go from. In terms of those records, Joe Cole was on BT Sport, and as I mentioned earlier, was very strong in his criticism. Also pointing out, Pad, that Chelsea eased to the 7-0 win without Romelu Lukaku, with N'Golo Kante on the bench, with no Timo Werner, who was also injured, Christian Pulisic also injured. They did still have four Ballon d'Or nominees in that team, two of them in the starting lineup in Jorginho and Mount, who got the hat-trick. An interesting question was put to me in our live blog, the NCFC live blog at pinken.com, every match day. In terms of percentage, how much of this game was Chelsea's class and how much of the percentage was Norwich being bad?
Impossible to answer, really. I mean,
I think I went 70-30 at the time, but, you know, I was in the moment, 70-30 in terms of Chelsea being good.
Yeah, no. I think I'd have to raise the 30% threshold for Norwich being bad. They were atrocious. All they were missing, some of those players, were the autograph books, because they looked starstruck on the pitch. And, you know, there's a way, as Connor said, as I said yesterday, there's a way to get beat. That isn't it. That lack of intensity. I mean, we'll pick out probably the key area, which was Kovacic and Jorginho completely dominated McLean. Norman, Lees Malou wasn't even a contest. Embarrassingly one-sided, that area. And that ultimately, you look at a lot of the goals, it's got the imprint of Kovacic or Jorginho on those goals. And Mount will obviously get the headlines. Reece James, excellent as well, two young English players. But they were the two, really, probably, ultimately, who underpinned that, well, mauling, essentially. And, you know, For me, I can't fathom is that, you know, Farke must be able to see that. You know, we were in a very close vantage point to him, and he just seemed a very frustrated man. He was almost conducting an orchestra, but they clearly wasn't playing the tune he wanted. He's just arms windmilling about at the front of his technical area. Surely he can see that Jorginho and Kovacic, midway through that second and first half even, are so dominant, and why doesn't he change it? Whether that's personnel or whether that's set up. You know, a lot of talk has been made about base formations, but you know, that needed an in-game change, and it might not have had any material impact ultimately, but it was so easy for Chelsea. And yes, I thought within the game they coasted for large parts, and it was just little foot went down gently on the accelerator, bang, move, goal, sit back again for another 10 or 15 minutes, wait, Norwich doing nothing, not threatening us, bang, pass, goal, move. And, you know, ultimately, there's not much more to add to what Connor's already said, that it was an atrocious display on the back of two very encouraging, albeit still raising questions about the lack of attacking productivity, but at least gave the impression they could be competitive. And yes, Chelsea aren't Burnley or Brighton, but they all inhabit the same Premier League. And if Norwich essentially are writing off club games against the elite this season, which was more or less Daniel's inference before and after the game, then it's going to have to come against the Brightons and the Burnleys, and 0-0 draws aren't going to be enough. And these next five games, starting with Leeds, will probably ultimately decide his fate, and on a broader point, probably Norwich's fate in terms of their Premier League status. But it isn't looking good at the moment. I think that was a major retrograde step to lose in a spirited, battling fashion where you've had a go, and maybe Chelsea's greater quality, even without a Lukaku or a Werner or a Pulisic, has won the day. Then let's be honest, you know, they're Champions League winners for a reason. They're top of the Premier League for a reason. That they are a very, very good outfit, probably as good a side as any in Europe at the minute. So no disgrace to lose there. There is in losing seven and raising the white flag and looking a rabble by the end. They just looked like a group of individuals who, but to a man, pitched up there with no belief that they could pull off a result. And if they don't believe, why should the fans believe?
Quite. Right. Normally we go through the game sort of stage by stage, don't we? But I want to fly through that really and just quickly go through the seven goals briefly. Connor, I'll come to you at halftime, and then Pad, I'll come to you at full time. And then I want us to move forward and start talking about what this means for Farke, what it means in terms of the Leeds and Brentford games. Because this was a 12:30 kickoff, it was live on BT, it was second on Match of the Day in the end because Watford went and came back to win 5-2 at Everton, which is an unbelievable result. And we will no doubt talk about that further as well. But Daniel stuck with the 3-5-2, kept faith with Sargent up front alongside Pukki, went with the team. I thought that was fair enough. I thought that keeping a settled team, keeping with the experience was sensible, given they were on the back of 2-0 draws. I just could not see that performance coming. Those same set of players lurching from two clean sheets to just being so far off it. And Daniel admitting that basically they were, in terms of thought, just so slow to react to what Chelsea offered. First goal, eighth minute, Mason Mount, lovely finish, but it comes from Kabak and Lise Malou just trailing at Hudson-Odoi on the Chelsea left. Norman gets dragged far too deep. McLean is outnumbered as Gibson heads the ball out from the cross. And then it's a nice finish, which Mount squeezes between his legs. The second comes in the 18th minute. Josh Sargent actually won the ball high at the pitch, but then a poor pass from Pukki gave the ball to Thiago Silva. Sargent doesn't do it anywhere near enough to try and win the ball back. Lise Malou also slow to try and stop Kovacic, who just slides a lovely pass between the gaping hole between Kabak and Hanley. And then it's a tidy finish from Hudson-Odoi. Just has cruel to beat into the bottom right-hand corner. And it's 3-0 by half-time. 42nd minute is the third goal. Kabak really plays Krul into trouble. Bad back pass, which Krul has to shank left-footed straight out to Kovacic. Jorginho out to Mount. McLean's too slow. And Yiannoulis has completely lost Reece James. And then it's a nice little chip over Tim Krul for 3-0 at half time. Now, Connie, you're the 3-4-3 man. You're our official 3-4-3 correspondent. That's what the drum you've been banging for the last few weeks, really, isn't it? In terms of that's where you're hoping they're going to progress to eventually. So Daniels decides at that point at 3-0 at half time to, I guess, start laying the building blocks for moving to that shape in the weeks ahead. Brings Williams on for Yiannoulis, just like he did at Manchester City, and Rashica comes on for Lise Malou on the left wing with Sargent on the right wing. So at half time, what were your thoughts in terms of him doing that rather than, I don't know how you shut up shop more from a 3-5-2 short of just telling all 10 players to stand in your own penalty area? But yeah, at half time, what did you think of him making that move?
Yeah, I was quite surprised, I think, because when you're losing a game 3-0, as you say there, you probably maybe look to go the other way and make sure that it doesn't become any more damaging, particularly given the nature of their first half performance. If anything, I felt there was probably a bit more of an argument to start the way he went at half-time rather than go to what he did at half-time. I think, if anything, they needed to get more men into, if they possibly could, get more men into midfield and make sure that they shut down the supply line that Kovacic and Jorginho were providing. I mean, anyone watching that game would have thought social distancing had been sort of re-implemented, because Norwich didn't get anywhere near those two all game, really. So, yeah, I mean, to essentially chuck on another attacker and hope that gave them something the other way, I felt was a questionable decision at that point. I think it then becomes even more questionable when Ben Gibson does what Ben Gibson does in the second half, which you'll come on to, obviously. So I didn't necessarily think it was right, but I guess in his mind, he had to do something. And I've kind of been thinking, actually, this morning about when you're a team that maybe doesn't have as much quality as your opponents, well, what do you do in that situation? And my mind keeps going back to what Ishmael did at Barnsley last season. It's probably not the most relevant or pertinent example that you can use, but he essentially made them perform very, very well in albeit the Championship, a different level, whatever. But he made them perform above their ability, as we're seeing this season, simply by implementing a game plan that saw them press really intensely, do something a little bit different, cause their opposition headaches. I just don't see Norwich doing anything similar at the moment. I think they're too easy to play against. Teams can work them out quickly. We saw Chelsea do it after basically 5 minutes, where they worked out actually they had a little bit of space. And then as soon as they worked that out, it was almost like someone had flicked a switch and that was it, really. It's difficult now, I think, after a 7-0. And I'm sure we'll get into sort of what direction Norwich City go from here. But talk about a 3-4-3. I mean, what on earth does Daniel Farke do now? Because do you go to that, and do you hope that offers you a little bit more at the top end of the pitch, knowing that you've just come out of a 7-0 defeat? Or do you stick with a 3-5-2? Again, probably questions we'll ask later on, but I didn't think it was probably the right call at that time. I felt they probably needed a bit more pace up top. I probably would have brought Rashica on for Sargent, maybe, but to throw in another attacker, I think, at that stage, when maybe what was necessary was to ensure that didn't become any more damaging, was questionable for me, but obviously speaking with hindsight.
Yes, and it didn't prove too successful, because another four goals followed, including a red card. To be fair, Rashica did have a chance, didn't he, at 3-0, when Pukki had got a little deflection on a pass from Kovacic, I think it was, wasn't it? And then Rashica is through on goal, pounces on it, but Mendy comes out of his goal, does really well. That was actually credited as a shot on target, which I think was quite generous. the only one of Norwich's three that was on target, the best chance really was Kabak in the first half, wasn't it, who fired one over the bar after striding forward and got a deflection on it, but for some reason the referee didn't give a corner. Chelsea had 23 shots and 13 of them were on target overall. So we got 12 minutes of the second half before another goal was conceded. Williams on the left, right in front of Farke, challenges with James in sort of midair. They both go for the ball, decides to go down and try and win a foul. I didn't think it was a foul. Daniel Farke didn't sound particularly convincing that it was a foul after the game. But then they just stride through. Jorginho and Mount cut out Norman with a 1-2. Kovacic sets up Chilwell. And again, it is a very nice finish. We are talking about the European champions and Premier League leaders. The fifth goal comes just 5 minutes later. Kovacic and Hudson-Odoi gets Hudson-Odoi down the left. Aaron's deflection. Krul can't keep it out. It's 5-0. Then Gibson gets sent off in the 61st minute at 5-0. Already on a yellow card. Slams into a tackle on James. Off he goes. He gets a one-game ban, punches the advertising hoardings above the tunnel as he goes in. And then this phase of the game, Pad, is what I'm referring to as salt being rubbed into the wound. As we sort of sat there laughing, didn't we? Because it was getting so ridiculous. But Krul makes a few good saves. Then Norman handles in the box. As soon as we see the replay in the press box, we know what's coming before the referees even looked at the screen. They get the penalty. Krul saves, but then same situation. We see the replays. We know that they're going to make them take it again because Krul comes off his line. That's the laws of the game. Tough luck. Mount just about squeezes it past Krul's foot for 6-0 in the 85th minute. And then the last one, Loftus-Cheek for 7-0 in the first minute of added time. He's just about onside after a VAR check. Draws Krul out of his goal, squares to Mount to complete his hat-trick. And that, Mr. Dabbitt, was 7-0. And means that it's 23 games without a Premier League win in London for Norwich, still going back to that win at Tottenham in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, that point and the one you made at the outset, DF, about this isn't just Farker or Weber in the Premier League with Norwich. It feels like, I don't know what it is. There's a UEA academic study there to be made about what is it about Norwich City in the Premier League era, really. So you're talking sort of Nigel Worthington onwards, aren't you, ultimately? Well, sort of modern Premier League era, that they're not able to certainly be residually competitive enough. I think as I say, we'd have to, you know, get the brightest academic brains across Norfolk to come together to crunch some numbers and extrapolate some of the findings, because what we're experiencing now is what has been experienced in different phases under Hughton, Neil Adams to a lesser extent, Worthington, and Alex Neil, of course, as well. And I don't know. Is it a resigned that is Norwich in the Premier League and we can't hope for any better? You'd like to think that a code can be cracked and we're probably veering dangerously into self-sustainable model territory, and I don't think we need to go down that route per se. But it just feels that on a more ephemeral point, you know, can Norwich sustain themselves in the Premier League, whatever they're not doing on the pitch? And I don't know. Ultimately, maybe that's going too deep down a philosophical wormhole. But, you know, if it fails as graphically as it's looking like it's going to fail this time around, then I think there's going to have to be, not just on the football side of the business, but maybe in terms of the ownership, and that's going to have to be revisited. Or, you know, ultimately, despite all the angst and embarrassment and disappointment that Norwich fans feel at the minute, an acceptance maybe that this is the cycle, you know, and are you happy to have good years in the Championship and then diabolical years in the Premier League? I don't know. I don't think it's a palatable relationship or a palatable state of affairs that no Norwich fan wants to be going through what they're going through at the minute, watching their side look so far off it. But how does it change? I don't know the answer to that. And ultimately, nobody who's been associated with Norwich since probably Worthington's era has really had the answers, bar, you know, there was a season under Lambert, of course, and then Hughton kept them up that first season under him. But either side of that, it's been pretty much where we are now is what Norwich fans have had to experience in the Premier League era. So I don't know. We've gone a bit too deep there, but given we were just dissecting a defeat at Chelsea, but you begin to think, is it ultimately, we can get into the Farker managerial status, but changing the manager, does that change anything materially? Not sure.
Yeah, it is a moral dilemma at the moment, isn't it? And I think most City fans were there when Alex Neil went. And then, of course, the new regime managed to find some way of making it work. And the tantalising thing about it all, I think, for me, is that just one season of survival would change the narrative so much. You wouldn't have to sell your best player. You might still do it because Stuart Webber might decide that it's time to let Todd Cantwell or Max Aarons go or whatever and use that money well. And they'd be able to spend a little bit more. And every year they stay up, that self-funded model would almost become the envy of the rest of English football. But until you manage it, then you're just leaving yourself open to ridicule almost, aren't you? Because you're trying to play almost a different game to everyone else, or you're playing the same game but by different rules. And it is very difficult for a lot of supporters to stomach. And I can understand when things are this bleak that, well, you can't really ask fans to keep the faith right now. Even if you come out with some sort of tub-thumping message, it's difficult to get that through to some people who will have just made up their mind by this point, won't they? Connor, I wanted to throw Daniel Farker's quote your way, which I wasn't particularly keen on. And I think he's maybe too honest for his own good at times. In his post-match, he said, "Even with our best possible performance, if Chelsea had a good day, they would still win." Now, That's true. We know it's true. Everyone knows it's true. They are owned by a billionaire. They are European champions, top of the Premier League. They have got some sensational players who, thankfully, some of them weren't even playing on Saturday. But is it, do you want to hear it? Do the players want to hear that? Do the fans want to hear that? Is it good in terms of psychology to actually say those words rather than just finding some way of putting an inspirational spin on that?
I think there's a time for realism and a time where fans almost want to be lied to a little bit. And these situations are probably those. And I know, I mean, we had it 2 years ago, didn't we? We had this debate every week. It'd be a miracle if Norwich could stay up. Well, maybe what Paddy said there in the mentality aspect, that has to come from the top. There's a reason Norwich City players walked out at Stamford Bridge with their autograph books. And as Paddy said earlier, it's because they've already been told that the task they're going out to do is the toughest in world football. Immediately, that does not set a particularly good tone. And Paddy references the Paul Lambert team, which is obviously the one that was capable of staying in this league. Well, that went to Anfield and it got a draw. It went to Chelsea and it didn't buckle. And they went toe-to-toe with some really big teams and got some brilliant results in really tough places. 3-3 against Arsenal off the top of my head. There are numerous others. You can't just strike a line through 12 games and say, oh yeah, well, we're going to lose those anyway, because it's the mentality effect of what that does to your players. So for me, there's an aspect of that that comes from the top. And I've got no doubt in my mind that if you're Brentford and Thomas Frank isn't sending his team out there against Liverpool, Chelsea, who they played a week ago and only lost 1-0 and were probably unlucky not to get a point, there's no way he's sending his players out there saying, oh, well, this is the toughest task in world football and all of that stuff. So, yeah, I think the tone of it has to change. It has to change. I'm not a psychologist, but that cannot be good as a professional footballer. We don't know, obviously, what the message is internally, but I think there's Norwich City players at the moment are going out to certain games without there being an expectation. And again, all of this stuff in matches about being competitive, well, actually, the aim has to be higher than that. It doesn't matter how you do it or in what games you do it or who the opponent is. They need to get points. They need to get wins. They need to get draws as well, which are vitally important across the season. And you need to do that irrespective of the opposition. If you're on a pitch with them for 90 minutes, it's 11v11. And OK, you may not be as good as Chelsea, but be the best version of Norwich City that you can be. And that has to be the message. And whilst it's setting targets like being competitive or, 99 times out of 100, we lose this game. Yeah, it's true. It's realistic. It's maybe tempering expectations a little bit, but it's not working on the pitch, is it? It didn't work in the last Premier League campaign. It's not working this time. So, yeah, look, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know the exact effects it can have on people and messaging and whatnot. But as Paddy said, that must feed into the mentality side of it, because everyone will remember Chris Hughton coming out before a game and almost hyping up the opposition. This kind of feels like squashing Norwich a little bit, because they've got some really good talent, and at the moment they're not utilising it, and they're almost rolling over and letting their tummies get tickled by teams who have a lot of quality. And you know, if you're not as good as a team, as I said earlier, you at least show some fight, some commitment. There's a minimum level that you have to meet. There are fundamentals and non-negotiables that you have to raise the bar to. And at the moment, they're not doing that. And sadly, I think whenever a team is like that, a team is always reflective of its head coach. And that's probably where the buck has to stop, doesn't it? So it's difficult. It's difficult. And being a Norwich manager in the Premier League is difficult with the resource and the environment and as Paddy says, this narrative and the perception of Norwich as well. That's a difficult thing to manage, all of that. But at some point you have to show some guts and you have to find a way. And at the moment they're not doing that, and Daniel Farker isn't doing that either. And if anything, just strip it all back, whether it's, you can debate whether it's having an impact on performances or not, strip it all back. It's not good PR for the fans, ultimately. And it's not sending the right messages out of what Norwich City want to be in the Premier League either. So, yeah, it's not working. And I don't think it's really helping anyone.
No, I think there's a craving almost of that spirit that Sheffield United had in that first season that was so successful, that Burnley have had for a long time, that Leeds have. You know, they're northern clubs and they go down to London because they want to you know, piss on the party, frankly.
Well, we were talking about Turf Moor a couple of weeks ago. We went there. It's almost like a siege mentality, isn't it? It's them against the world. Norwich don't have that. The Carrow Road's a nice place to come and play. Norwich are probably a nice team to play. And they don't have that sort of us feet the world mentality that maybe they did have under Paul Lambert and why they were so successful. And it's not they need to roll their sleeves up and go out and two-foot people. That's not the case at all. I think it's a mentality point, isn't it? And at the moment, that feels quite off, I think.
Yeah, Leeds fans, we're Leeds, we're Yorkshire, we're not going to be cowed by anyone, particularly by London clubs. They travel with spirit and hope, don't they? And there's not enough of that, it's felt. You know, maybe Daniel's just too nice and just too honest for his own good at times. And he does obviously say some of the right things in with the mix, but just at the moment, it doesn't feel like that balance is correct. All of this made worse, of course, Pad. Well, we're travelling home and we can hear the Watford goals going in, made even worse by the Chelsea fans in having quite a rowdy party on the same tube carriage as us for a while away from Stamford Bridge. But you watch the Watford highlights and Ranieri obviously had a very painful first game. Was it 5-0 at home to Liverpool? They lost. But you can see they are fighting for every second ball. They're pressing, they're fighting. They are in Everton's face. And then they end up scoring some very good goals with a great deal of spirit. So I guess where this whole discussion has come round to is to Daniel Farke, is to what happens next. And, you know, the mention of Lambert there, I've even seen some people jokingly suggest bring Lambert back. I don't think anyone seriously is saying that. And that's where I think this is settled on today, is that a lot of people are calling for Daniel Farke to go. There's no avoiding that. But I think the bigger question almost is, well, who do you replace Farke with? With everything that we've just said, with the model, with the self-funded restrictions and stuff, Stuart Webber has got to be able to go to the board and propose that he has a better option than Daniel Farke, who can now take this team on. So, you know, who is that? Steve Bruce? He's just come out of Newcastle looking like he very much needs a holiday. I don't think he's going to be jumping back into football. Seems unlikely. He, you know, he might fit the right sort of profile and he's got the Norwich links and things like that. Roy Hodgson, how old is he now? 72, something like that. Someone even mentioned Martin O'Neill yesterday, but, you know, I think he's kind of yesterday's man. He didn't go very well at Nottingham Forest. And talking about people like Eddie Howe, Frank Lampard, that's not going to happen. They're not going to come to Norwich with the financial restrictions that they've got and in the situation that they are in. So this isn't a straightforward decision. It's not just Daniel Farke's not doing well. We've got to move on from him.
Absolutely not. I don't, straight off the bat, that I can't. I just do not see a firefighting type appointment, which is Hodgson et al. That just flies in the face of the deep foundations they've tried to put in place, the philosophy and the cultures, and not being buffeted by what happens on a Saturday or a Sunday in the Premier League or a Tuesday or a Wednesday in the Championship over a course of 90-minute game. And for that reason alone, I just don't see Stuart Webber going out and getting in somebody who isn't essentially a Daniel Farke clone, who's willing to buy into the model, willing to work in a sporting director, head coach, European, continental style model, the developing still young players, albeit in the Premier League and the most, as we saw yesterday, brutally illustrated, the most demanding environment you could have to try and hothouse younger players, particularly any player, but certainly younger players. But that's still one of the pillars of what Webber and Farke have erected, and having a say in transfers. But ultimately, you know, it's Webber and his recruitment team who are making the calls on that. So for that reason, for those reasons alone, and unless it's a right 3-4 years down the line, a model that's delivered 2 championship titles, has delivered, not at the minute, but certainly for the most part, a very attractive brand of football that is stabilised financially, a club that was heading to the abyss, the infrastructure developments that we saw again recently at Colney, and the continuing ongoing developments there planned in the future. All of that, are you saying, right, that's the end of that, and now we're going to go back to the boom and bust cycle, and it's all about what happens on the pitch on a Saturday or a Sunday or whatever day of the week? No, is the answer. That's not going to happen as long as Webber's at the helm. So ultimately, you're looking for another Farke type appointment. And if this is heading back to the Championship and you need somebody to get yourself out of the Championship, then there's no better man than Daniel Farke. He's got 2 championship titles on his CV. So again, it's that contradiction slash inherent tension between, do you actually accept that this is a, let's put a yo-yo label on it, footballing culture, but certainly in terms of oscillating between the two divisions. You're not hearing the top 26 mantra anymore because they hoped that was behind them and that they could now establish themselves as a top 20, if all things went to plan, a top 17 club in the Premier League, i.e. regular membership of the Premier League. But although we're not hearing the top 26 from anybody inside Carr Road, if that is still ultimately what the overarching ambition of the football club is, then you're accepting you're going to be up and down and up and down. And if that's the case, then I don't think a short-term knee-jerk managerial appointment that doesn't really fit the philosophy is really how Norwich will go. You can debate whether, to take your point, DF, earlier, you know, the self-sustainable thing could work if they manage to stay up, and maybe a Hodgson, for example, could allow them, with his experience and his vast knowledge and his track record of keeping teams in the Premier League, could he get them to that bridge and get them over that hump? And then you say, thanks, Roy, for your short-term firefighting mission. It's been a huge success against the odds. But now we're going to go back to a Farker-style coaching appointment. Possibly. There's a route to what they're trying to do there. So you still retain a true belief in the values that they've tried to instill in the football club at all levels, on and off the pitch. But I still don't see that. I just don't see Daniel getting the bullet. And that's not, just to reiterate, it's not going to happen anytime this side of Leeds. There's no moves inside the club. There's no feeling that that's how they want to go with the head coach. Whether that changes the other side of Leeds, if we're still talking about, you know, a 10th game without a win and an abject performance, then who knows? But certainly this side of Leeds, it won't be a change. And ultimately, it's in Daniel Farker's hands now. He's if he's not already in it, he's entering the last chance saloon, and he's probably got a clump of games, maybe depending on how Leeds go, just the one game. But he's certainly got a few games to turn this around. And if he doesn't, then whether Weber wants it to do it or not, the trigger will get pulled, and he will then have to ultimately, despite me saying how difficult the choice is to find another head coach who fits the criteria, he will have to try and do that. And what we do know about Stuart Weber, I don't think he will be sitting on his hands and suddenly it'll be Daniel's gone and then he turns over and it's a blank piece of paper. I think he will have succession planning in some shape or form, and he will have targets in place. But I don't think there's any desire on his part at this minute to actively go down that route. So difficult, yeah. Ultimately, Daniel Farker has to produce or he'll be out the door, but who follows next? I don't think it's clear. I really don't think it's clear. It's certainly not clear to the point where you could say manager X would be the next cab off the rank. I just don't see that at all.
Yeah, I think it's far more likely it would be another overseas appointment, someone that we're not expecting or is maybe a bit of an unknown to us at this moment in time. And if Weber hasn't got that name, that shortlist, I'm knowing how he operates, I'd be very sure that he has already got a name in mind of who he would like to get if possible. But yeah, I think it would be a failure in his duty, really, if he didn't have a shortlist of who could be potentially replacing the head coach in the situation they're in. And kind of just to finish part one with, really, I think Weber is a big part of this as well, isn't it? We saw Farker sign a new four-year deal. There's still the uncertainty as to whether Weber will stay next summer. He suggested he might be willing to stay a bit longer because of COVID and Brexit and all the sort of stuff that we've discussed at length previously. But ultimately, if Daniel Farker wants to be a top coach and wants to manage in the Champions League and challenge for trophies and things like that, if Stuart Weber wants to be a sporting director at Liverpool or Manchester United or whoever it may be, he has also got pressure on him right now to get things right. And sporting directors at times have to make tough decisions. They have to replace a head coach who, obviously, there's a great deal of affection and friendship between them, but he's always made clear that if he had to make that tough decision, he would do. And the ball is in Weber's court, isn't it?
Yeah, I think people will be looking on more with the fact that if this was any other club, Daniel Farker probably wouldn't still be here. And he probably wouldn't have been here after Project Restart.
I'll interrupt you, sorry, very slightly, but my girlfriend doesn't know anything about football. But when I came home last night, I was moaning a little bit. And she said, surely any other football club, he'd have been sacked by now, wouldn't he? And literally, so she doesn't even follow football, and she can see that that is the truth. And I saw quite a few comments like that on social media saying, any one of the other 92 clubs, Farker would be gone by now. And that is true, isn't it? This is, we're in this sort of weird, unique little bit of limbo.
Yeah, and if they fail to win against Leeds, it'll be, what, 19 Premier League games without a win across, I know it spans two seasons, so whether you want to judge it like that or not, that's essentially half a Premier League season without a win. I mean, it would be incredible for that to happen, and any head coach, manager, irrespective of who they are or what they've done, to be in post, I think. So it does become difficult, but as we discussed earlier, and as Paddy put so well, it's difficult for, particularly at the moment, to see a who they would get, and I think it would have to be an overseas appointment. I think just the way they work and how they operate. But equally, if that person is in post somewhere else, how you attract them to come and work at Norwich City, given the situation at the moment, it's not going to be, okay, it's a Premier League job, and so that may help in terms of attracting it. But in terms of situation, it would be a very difficult club, a very difficult job for anybody to walk into and turn around immediately. So I'm not entirely sure a change of head coach would dramatically shift things at this moment in time for where Norwich City are, but equally, as we've said, it would be an inevitability if this continues. So that's difficult. But another sort of side of this as well is their model, and we speak so much about it, this sporting director head coaching, and the whole purpose of bringing it in was this idea that by having a sporting director, that's kind of your pillar, that's the stability in the club, and that almost takes the pressure off the head coach to an extent. That position becomes a little bit more dispensable, and we're almost in this weird situation where they've probably got more stability from Daniel Farker at the moment than they have Stuart Webber. You look at their respective contract situations, so that's another element. If Stuart Webber is going to have to go out at some stage and recruit a new head coach, then they're probably going to ask him the question of, well, are you going to be here next summer? Because if I'm going to walk into a club and you're going to be my boss, if we get relegated and then suddenly in the summer you wave, okay, I'm off and a new man's in, and they may suddenly decide that they don't want whoever that person is in post. So it doesn't help anybody, I don't think. And then, of course, this is all coming off the back as well of a club who in the summer lost its chief operating officer, saw a few scouts leave in fairly pivotal positions. It just feels like there's a real lack of stability at the moment, and it feels like a club who maybe wasn't fully prepared for the challenge ahead in the summer. So I think there's probably a lot of questions that will follow this week, and that they're going to have to stand up to and take and channel into a performance next weekend. But for me, if we get to, as I said earlier on, if we get to post Leeds and Norwich City haven't won that football match, then forget everything else. I think the supporters are going to be pretty unified, and that response at Carrow Road is going to become pretty toxic. And strip it all back, Daniel Farker and the work he's done at Norwich City over the last 4 years, he doesn't deserve it to go that way. So yeah, at some point, if this persists, Stuart Webber's going to have to make a decision. And if ultimately their form doesn't turn around, it'll be when rather than if we're talking about a new Norwich City head coach. But who that is and the profile of it and how they go about it, I think at this stage is potentially very difficult.
Yeah, there was also a comment in our live blog saying that they'd be heartbroken to see Farker have to go through what Nigel Worthington went through in that game against Burnley when everything turned nasty, or, you know, Gunny in the Colchester game. It's nobody wants to see Daniel have to go through all that. So I'm sure there will be a huge amount of people still will be desperately hoping that Daniel Farker can somehow find a way to get that win and keep going, because as everyone has repeatedly said, he is a good man. He is a good character. He's done a huge amount for the club. He has had a massive, massive impact and is going to be remembered as a legendary figure of the club. But it's very interesting times. Right, let's take a deep breath and we will come back to you for part two when we're going to talk Todd Cantwell.
Welcome to the new normal.
Hello, and welcome to this series of Unfinished with me, Charles Thompson.
Welcome to Weird Norfolk.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinkin.com Norwich City podcast.
From true crime to football, politics to folklore, for more great podcasts from Archand, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archand.
Right, a few little bits of news just wanted to get through before we get into the chat about Todd Cantwell, Billy Gilmore and the Leeds and Brentford game, just to finish off with. I'm sure you will have all have seen it. If not, head to the EDP Evening News or Pinkham website. It's Daniel Barden, the club's young goalkeeper, has been diagnosed with testicular cancer. They're hoping they've caught it early, but he is taking time away from the game for treatment. The players were all wearing warm-up T-shirts at Stamford Bridge with Barden 50 on and a supportive message on the front. So our best wishes go to Dan, who, of course, stepped in so well during last season when Tim Krul was injured. Is on loan at Livingston, hasn't really played a great deal. Couple of caps for the Wales under-21s in recent months as well. So, yeah, fingers crossed that they've caught that early and Dan can get back on with his football career unaffected. Christoph Zimmermann will be having ankle surgery. Daniel Farke had trailed that ahead of the Brighton game. That is, I think Daniel said that would be happening on Monday. Sam Byram completed his first full week of training. So obviously they're still treating him with kid gloves. It's not like he's going to be available for selection anytime soon, but a step in the right direction, certainly for Sam after over 18 months out. And Max Aarons as well was on Fabrizio Romano's Twitch stream talking about his new agent and how Rio Ferdinand is his mentor. As me and Connor discussed a bit in our preview video on Friday night, you don't go on that sort of a show unless you are trying to raise your profile for potential transfers. I think it's probably not too controversial to say. Paddy, let's talk Todd Cantwell. It was the big issue of the pre-match press conference, and then he pops up at the walks on Friday night. And I put this to you in the car, really, didn't I? That, as we said in part one, we don't expect Farke to go before the Leeds game. But if, theoretically, he were to be dismissed or resign or whatever, and a new manager was put in place ahead of that Leeds game, who can you almost guarantee would be in the starting lineup against Leeds? It would probably be Todd Cantwell.
Well, possibly, yeah. Hopefully, maybe Zolis might get a look in as well. He's the invisible man at the minute. For me, that's on a personal level anyway. But, yeah, well, as we don't expect that to happen, and I don't think we'll be parachuting Todd back into his plans for Sunday. I think that much is clear from everything that Daniel said on Friday. Last, we kind of got into this a little bit on the pre-match team news at Stamford Bridge, didn't we? But ultimately, we take Daniel at face value, and you know this is really about Todd now knuckling down and training regularly, week in, week out, getting to the mental and physical levels required in Daniel's view to be a factor in his planning. Then the ball's firmly in Todd's court, and for me personally, it was good to see that he captained the side there at King's Lynn. Bit of extra responsibility there. He you know, by his performance levels, by all accounts, anecdotally from what we've heard, you know, he played very well and obviously got himself on the score sheet from the penalty spot, and that's all he can do. You know, ultimately he'll come back into the mix now this week. And if he shows by his performances in training, then I think it would be a good signal. I remember actually in the dim and distant, was it Josh Murphy got himself the wrong side of Farke, and can't even remember what that was over, but he was straight back in. Yeah, that Tim Closer in the boat. Yeah, that's it. But I think he actually brought him straight back in. I think Reading off the top of my head springs to mind, and that was a bit of a surprise that having pretty similarly with a young homegrown player really hung him out a little bit in public. He brought him back into the fold. So it isn't beyond the realms under this head coach. The precedent is there that Todd is back in the mix. But I think it's quite a leap to go from what he said last Friday to him in the 11 come Sunday against Leeds. But I think for a manager who probably needs to earn a little bit of brownie points from an increasingly growing constituency of Norwich fans, I think Cantwell on the 20 long list when the team news drops Sunday afternoon wouldn't be the worst scenario, I think, because a team who have a chronic inability to score goals at this level or even create, you know, Brighton aside maybe, but create enough, then Todd Cantwell is in that equation all day long within the current roster, as is Zolis. I think if Norwich had, without wanting to go back into the Chelsea post-mortem. But if Norwich had come out of that game, it'd been a very narrow defeat, but we'd seen more evidence defensively that, you know, they're on the right track, then I think there's less of a call to do too much at the top end of the pitch. But, you know, if you've pivoted away post-Watford from a lot of what you were about as a head coach in your time at Norwich and gone more defensively and pragmatically, and that isn't working either, albeit it was Chelsea, you know, testing the durability of Norwich defensively. But if that doesn't work, then for me, where he is now, just roll the dice and start to inject some of that creativity they're so sorely lacking. Sargent and Pukki, not for me anymore, I think. I think the time has come to break up that partnership. And if there's a vacancy, then I'd like to see Zolas in personally. And I think Rashica in, albeit smaller cameos, but he's not showing enough for me. I think we saw enough from Zolas, both against Liverpool and Bournemouth, in those League Cup ties. And yes, we know it's the League Cup, but ultimately Sargent's had a run in the side and he doesn't look like a man capable of scoring a goal. So I'd like to see Zolas in. And I think in terms of trying to turn what could be potentially a very toxic afternoon this coming Sunday, little elements like that, you know, Cantwell back in the mix, Zolas maybe in the 11. I think they're the sort of elements that at least will bring some of the disaffected back on side. But then ultimately, everything will be dictated by what the team he puts on the park produces against Leeds. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter what's said or done in the build-up. It's about now, the 90 minutes Sunday afternoon. So, Cantwell, yeah, like to see him back in the mix, but under this head coach, given what he said to us on Friday, we're not going to see him in the 11, I don't think.
Yeah, it's about what happens behind the scenes at Colney this week, isn't it, in terms of whether they kiss and make up, whether Todd does enough to persuade Daniel that he's rowing in the right direction. Similarly, for the Leeds game, Connor, Billy Gilmore will come back into availability, at least. He couldn't play against his parent club. He popped up in the press box at the end, didn't he? Saying hello to the Chelsea media team and things like that. Of course, his club, where he's been for a few years now. We discussed this a bit on Friday in the preview video, didn't we? But Thomas Tuchel was quite strong with his quotes ahead of the game, basically saying, if you want to be a Chelsea player, you've got to be successful at the loan club. You've got to be the top player there. And no manager in the world leaves his best players out if he has to. So basically he was saying, he was putting the challenge very much at Gilmore's door that don't come crying home to me. You've got to go and make success of it at Norwich.
Yeah, and I agree with him as well. I'm fascinated, really fascinated with how Daniel Farke plays this, because there's probably an argument to go either way, and you could look to throw in all your attacking elements and maybe try and revert back to what Norwich City were good at last season. Or equally, you could see him going in the other direction and maybe looking to be even more pragmatic and even more solid than perhaps they've been in recent weeks. So, yeah, which one of those he chooses is going to be really interesting and may well hold the answer to whether we'll see Billy Gilmore, because Leeds at home, they're a possession-based side. That's going to be a game that's going to be on the floor. It may well be suited to Gilmore and his talents, because the way Leeds play, the way they attack, the way they press, they do leave spaces to exploit. And if you've got someone who can play a pass, can pick a pass like Billy Gilmore, then that could be a key to winning the football match if you get him in a position where he can break their press. So I don't think any of the midfield three really state their claim. I think you'd probably have Mateus Norman in there, wouldn't you? Depending on what sort of shape Daniel Farke and Norwich go for. And then I'm with Pad. I think you've got to unleash Christos Solis. You've got to move away from Sargent and Pukki. What that looks like in terms of a formation or a setup, I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't be surprised really if Norwich went back to a 4-3-3, particularly given Gibson is suspended. That may give them an opportunity too, but then is Daniel Farke going to sacrifice what they've been building in the last few weeks with a three at the back? I can't see it. So I don't know is the honest answer. I don't know how Billy Gilmore gets in this team at the moment. But if he can't get in the team after a midfield display like that, then I think in many ways, the writing is probably on the wall for him at Norwich City, I would say, because if there's any chance for him to get into this midfield, it would be after a 7-0 defeat, I would argue.
Absolutely, yeah. He'd be well within his rights to be asking some big questions then, wouldn't he, as to why he was signed. And Leeds, they've had a bit of an awkward start to the season, haven't they? They are one of the teams that have got a win now. They beat Watford 1-0 earlier or a couple of weeks ago, and they finished ninth last season. They impressed so much under Bielsa, didn't they? And Phillips, obviously very good for England. In the summer, Bamford has been a success for them. Phillips was back on the bench as they snatched a 1-1 home draw with Wolves on Saturday. So they're in terms of position, they're not great in the table. And I just had a quick check. It looks like Bamford and Luke Ayling won't be back from their injuries for the Norwich game, based on what Bielsa had said ahead of that one. Phillips didn't come off the bench, but you can just see him coming back and inspiring them to something, can't you? Because he's been in such sensational form this year. He is a hugely important player for them. They've got Dan James, who they signed from Man United, Rafinha. Anybody that looks at the Premier League table at the moment and sees Leeds as 17th and think that this is one where Norwich should definitely be able to win that one, would be forgetting a lot of what they've achieved under Bielsa, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would be. But ultimately, as with Norwich, you know, put what's happened with Daniel in the past to one side. It's about here and now. And if you look at Leeds, that where they are in the table, one win, and that was against the Watford side, tells you that things aren't anywhere near us. I think the only time I've seen them really this season was, I think, when they went to United. That was, if not the open.
Nope, you've gone on to mute pad.
Sorry. Yeah, it was the opening day of the season, and they got whacked 5-1, and they looked not dissimilar to Norwich yesterday at Stamford Bridge in terms of so open. And so naive, and looking at their results from afar, that they've obviously tightened up a little bit. They're not, I think Liverpool put three past them, but other than that, it's been the odd goal in a lot of the games that they've fallen the wrong side of. So injuries to key men as well, that's worth reiterating. But it has to be, it has, going back to what we've said as a running theme through here, I don't want to hear about what a messiah Bielsa is in the lead up to this game and how good Leeds are and how good Calvin Phillips is. Park it. I don't want to hear it. If you're a Norwich player or a Norwich fan, you don't want to hear it. Surely you want to be told that this is the game. These are the top of games against the top of opponents this season. Norwich have to pick up points. Watford was in that bracket. They failed miserably. And Brighton, okay, they ground out a point. Burnley, they ground out a point. But they haven't delivered so far in the games that you would pigeonhole as the ones they have to, and Leeds is very firmly in that category, irrespective of what has happened at Stamford Bridge or the early part of the season. So it has to be all about Norwich this weekend, and that's why I hope he goes, for me, a bit bolder, because Leeds under Bielsa will turn up and go for it. And I think if Norwich just sit back and invite Leeds on, then you know, I think ultimately they'll probably come up short. So let's probe Leeds for any vulnerability without the ball, as opposed to, you know, a template that is almost conceding the initiative to Leeds, because Leeds are the sort of team under Bielsa who, if they get any sense of, you know, they can get themselves on top, I think they will bully Norwich. And if that scenario plays out, then for all manner of reasons, it could be a very, very toxic afternoon. So, it has to be about Norwich this game, both in the build-up and on the day. Front foot, put your attacking players in the side and have a go.
Yeah, the last time they came to Carrow Road, that 3-0 win, they were very, very good that day, weren't they? When, of course, Norwich went on to win the title and Leeds choked at the end of the season. But yeah, we know that Bielsa can get them really purring at times. Right, boys, thank you very much for your thoughts. Thank you very much for listening and tuning in to this week's edition of the Pinkin.com Norwich City podcast in association with Future Radio 107.8 FM. Keep it locked on the EDP Evening News and Pinkin content. We are chasing various interviews and stories at the moment. It's clearly a very lively time in this phase of Norwich City history. And although we've got to wait until next Sunday afternoon for a game that's been televised by Sky for kickoff, I'd imagine it's still going to be quite a lively week in the build-up, because it is crunch time. There's no doubt about that. Leeds are in action on Tuesday night. They're at Arsenal in, I think that's the fourth round of the League Cup, isn't it? Although it didn't seem to do Chelsea too much harm playing on Wednesday night when they beat Malmo 4-0 in the Champions League with a full-strength side, and then managed to tonk Norwich 7-0 barely 3 days later. That will do for this week. Thank you very much for listening. We'll catch up with you soon.